looking at page 116, I find another paragraph that proves my point. He says, the perception of particular change or movement. Now, note, he's talking about rock, supposedly, but he's talking about his senses and about the mind-body issue or the perception-conception. He's always wrestling with what he would think is basic philosophical issues. But it's confronting whether he's experiencing it or not, which is what happens when you have a tactile environment. If you extend the central nervous system to the whole population, they don't know whether they exist anymore or not. They can't fit it into their own cultural way forms of knowing, because all those cultural forms of knowing are specialized and extensions of particular sensory biases. But when you get the whole complex coming back at you, you get into saying things like this. Okay, so Mesnes is describing, I'm watching TV, maybe later TV, remote jumping around with remote channeling, because back in the 50s, from our perspective, it was pretty slow TV, but it is heavy for people at that time because it's all the senses. So you're just trying to describe what's happening. You say the perception of particular change or movement within a continuous flow involves the perception of specific points and separated moments of attention, plus the apprehension of difference. Plus the apprehension of difference. That there has been change of movement. Now remember, tactility ain't going anywhere. You're just in this static, inter-resonating environment. So you have hyper speed as its content, hyper movement, but actually you're not going anywhere because you're instantly in touch with everything in the tactile electric extension. So you would write a sentence like this. It's almost like he's describing his reaction to reading a paragraph of Finnegan's Wake. The perception of particular change or movement of meaning within a continuous flow, endless flow in Finney's Wake, involves a perception of specific points, okay, glimpses of illusions, at separated moments of attention, separated because you're reading a book and it's separate words on the print page, plus the apprehension of difference on another level, that there has been change or movement. Not sure if there has been. Music of any degree of regularity, by fragmentizing change in motion as felt sequences of moments. Now, he's now saying music is better for describing what's really going on than the visual. Music, by fragmentizing change in motion as felt sequences of moments. Sequences of moments is linear, but it also is acoustic. Attended to into units of sound and silence. There's the interval, sound and silence. Put the two together, you got tactility, because there's the no content part of tactility. Inaudible vacillation controls more strongly than a mere continuum. Mere continuum would be literate page. An observer's right. Attention, and that's the perception of the particular change in movement. You sort of notice, it's like a fractal. You notice the little thing, and then it becomes the bigger pattern. Then it disappears, and you have a little different thing, little twist, and then it becomes the big pattern again. In music, there are additionally and necessarily momentary successions of non-configurations in alternation with successions of formal configurations. He's saying chaos order, movement, no movement. You see any dialectic. Now, if you try to read this and really pin it down, it might make a bit of literate sense, but not really going to. And okay. He's justified saying, I'm not writing, if you think of writing as trying to pin down the experience. He's incorporating the blur.
Okay.
So then you go over to page 117, and I think that point is said here in this long paragraph. But music, even if only empirically so, because of historical conditioning, he's sort of picking up that music, the oral culture, is a conditioned environment because we're now in a new environment. So you notice the conditioning of the older environment.
Right.
Even if only empirically so because of historical conditioning, is more capable of polarities essential for abrupt change than visual arts because of its fragmentized but tight structure. He's actually talking about acoustic. It's not really fragmentized. The rapidity of succession of these fragments possible before a perceiver, and the immediacy of the relationship of the perceiver to the art object, additionally allowing the greater persistence of parts through a totality in memory. Totality is a tactile. Now, the literate person, people think that listening to something is linear because you go from moment to moment to moment. They're forgetting right. The simultaneity of the acoustic experience where everybody can hear it who's in the room at the same time, so it's not just you, and it's quite simultaneous as well as sequential. But when you read a book by yourself, you have engaged in a sequential situation, but in even a more fragmented situation because you're doing it by yourself. You're not in a group.
Right.
And so he's playing off what McLuhan would call the eye and the ear, Wyndham Lewis and James Joyce, so to speak, here. He's saying music, even if only empirically so because of historical conditioning, is more capable of polarities. You've got to have the polarities to indicate tactility, because tactility is more than the polarities. It's instantly relating and creating ratios among the polarities, but it's not stuck with the polarities, right? So there's a kind of movement past that, which might appear to be stability or non-change, but there's still obvious change, at least on the ear's reception, because it's sort of sequential. So, is more capable polarities essential for abrupt change than visual arts? You see, that's why music took over. That's why art died. Music was the only way a private literate concern could be stabilized. Even though, to say what it means, to say what the values, you know, literate values are, can't find it. He's admitting that.
So let's go back a bit. Music is the only
the only way for a literate private concern to have a precious object, which literate society develops, commodification, having packages, as McLuhan would say. You've got materialism happening, material objects. You need that. But in a software environment where everybody has the same information, ownership becomes slightly not as important, because everybody's sharing the same TV program. I don't have to go and buy it, and only I have it. That's what McLuhan said, that television was software communism. It can't be bought, sold, or stolen in the TV environment. It just is, and everybody shares in it. So what do you do to assert your private literate identity of value and your special object, art object, or commodity? Not the painting, music. So you see, you know, 50 years ago, the beatniks, to create a sense of valuable experience, they call it jazz. They're very, very hypnotized by Charlie Parker or something. It's very important, and they argue over who's the better saxophonist or whatever. The thing is, music is where you assert your private identity. And yet, it's a flow. So there's Meltzer celebrating the flow, and not too much on the value of any particular experience, just looking for something that approximates it. And he doesn't like the further commodification of it in the late 60s, because that's when it's becoming too much of a private concern, and he translated into just capitalist imperialism, money taking over. But he recognizes the it's a tactile experience. You got to be at that concert at the right night in the club when it happens.
Right?
And any fragmenting of that up into a little record that replays it misses the tactile part. But he misses the larger dynamic of the culture, which needs, literate people need a valuable object. They've been conditioned to have that. So it's no longer necessarily art. It is a musical 45 or an album.
Right.
Because that's also the object is a way to translate the tactile thing, the tactile flow / non-flow. So go back to this. Remember, tactility means abrupt change. Because if you're perceiving, it's like frequency changes rather than kinetic movement changes. So he says, compared with the visual arts, music's components are simply located and diffusely located. Again, he's always putting in the paradox, right?
Right, yeah.
And, of course, that's hard to figure out what he means. He's saying it's both. It's the old thing, not either or, it's both and. Tactility is a statement, is said by both and. That's a new tactile dialectic.
Okay.
So compare with the visual arts, music's components are simply located and diffusely located and quantitatively denser. See, he's trying to say, look, the ear is more valid for expressing what's happening on television than anything you could see. But he knows that he's translating back into visual space as a writer, but he says, I know this ain't making any linear sense, so I'm painting, I'm visualizing.
Yeah.
Which is actually what he's doing. Once music has become regular and change can be felt against a patterned background, all its Heraclitean flux of Democritean atoms are literate citizens, separate atoms, inside the pre-literate Heraclitean flux, all this Heraclitean flux of Democritean atoms can be intensified in contrast to this regular background. But musicians like John Cage and Ornette Coleman have abandoned an explicit regularity for one merely implicit and relative within a chaos of irregularity, anti-regularity, irregularity, and random regularity. That's fucking tactility, man.
Okay.
He's trying to show it's not any of that, though you got to include them all and make the shift.
Right.
But the most radical form of chaos is order. Yes, when you're in a post-literate environment, literacy becomes a menace. It's a necessary technology. It's what we had for a couple thousand years, especially 500 years of print. So you have this order, and yet when you're once you're in an electric environment, you can look back at the Gutenberg galaxy, McLuhan called it, the literate phase, and see its disservices. And you could say it's chaos, because it is when it comes up against a literate environment, I mean a post-literate environment, because you can't reconcile the two modalities. And that's been the problem in the economy up to this point for 100 years.
Okay.
You can't, how can you make people work for little pieces of visual paper or credits when everything is immediately available already? People work so they can go home and listen to watch TV or go on the computer or listen to their iPod. You get the money to pay the rent so you can enjoy what's available everywhere. But you got to pay to put your visual body, your chemical body, in some place, right? That's the legacy of visual space. So he goes, but the most radical form of chaos is order. In fact, a permanently contingent order. Now, the Bilderbergers, the Tribal Commission, governments are permanently contingent order. They prop up visual space, industrial space, but they do not have any long-lasting, and they're changing and turning over all the time. You know, Italy has a new government every 12 months. So he doesn't know that's, I'm taking his words, you could say, out of context, but it actually fits.
Right, right.
And he is trying to write a book of philosophy to cover big issues, so I'm relating it to the big issues. But the most radical form of chaos is order. In fact, a permanently contingent order. McLuhan would say arbitrary, ad hoc order, ad hoc government. That's what we've had since the 60s. At any time in history, music is such an anaxagorean crystallization from the haze of psychological temporality. Now, psychological temporality might be tactility.
Okay.
And, see, he's sort of saying that music crystallizes it, stops the tactile flux, non-flux. Okay?
Right.
Tactility ain't going anywhere. It's just absorbing and sponging, SpongeBob. So the haze of psychological temporality. But today, after music of paradigmatic disorder has become historically prominent, he's talking about Ornette Coleman and Cecil Taylor and those guys and Coltrane, I assume they're right?
Yeah.
Has become, okay, but today after a music of paradigmatic disorder has paradigmatic disorder has become historically prominent, and music with a high degree of regularity, particularly one whose regularity becomes ultimately monotonous repetition, is even more radical. Correct. Because any genre of music in a tactile, multi-leveled environment, one music gets played off another music. One aspect of ear culture gets played off another. Both are relevant to the consumer as he tries to approximate and own the amazing ecology of tactility itself. See, so you know, you had the interesting, back in Duke Ellington's day, and that the big thing was, geez, Duke Ellington, you know, great jazz musician, but you know, he studies Stravinsky, studies classical music. You know, that was a big thing, that this mixing of the ear culture of the blacks with the eye culture of Europe. That was sort of not expected. At least the consumers didn't do it, but they didn't know the musicians did it. So then, now by the 70s and 80s, the average music consumer had a little jazz, had a little classical, had a little rock, had a little disco, had mixed it all up,
yeah.
Right? So the mixing, since the ear is more and more weaker, more and more irrelevant as the tactility takes over in the global theater and then the digitized environment, then you grab, it's like McLuhan, he would grab for any fact or anecdote for his books, the music, the literate person who needs music as a private concern for his identity becomes more haphazard in picking what he listens to.
Okay, Bob, why is the ear weaker? Because of tactility?
Yes, because once you get into the digital environment, that goes around the tactile TV environment. So the tactile TV has been superseded by a post-tactility. The strange thing I call the Android meme, living at the speed of thought, the digital computer world.
Okay.
That may take time to figure out what I mean, but McLuhan wrote about it in 1974 in an op-ed for the New York Times. We have moved to in a post-tactile environment. He saw that in the early 70s. So So therefore, the ear, if tactility now is becoming figure and it's the older environment, then being tactile is the art form. And the ear isn't that important. And that could explain why punk expressed that. Back with music, it's all ridiculous, right? But they were reacting to the spectacle, the televisual spectacle, the global theater spectacle. But after that, by the 80s, music is bland, perfunctory, techno, nothing. You will find some music you like in there, but it's not taken that seriously. It's only taken seriously by young kids because they're just growing up in acoustic space. They have no clue. But the older, the baby boomers by the 80s, they'll listen to anything.
Right, right.
Because the ear has become weaker as a definition of their identity. So how do you make tactility your identity? Well, you become a yuppie and make lots of money and be a vegetarian and take drugs and also take regular medicine. You mix up all the cultures. You become a collage. You become a health nut who's an alcoholic.
Right.
And consumes many kinds of magazines. I mean, just become a gluttonous, and the 80s were known as the time of excess, a gluttonous last stage of old analog media, a gluttonous imbibing of everything, and looking very wasteful. And what is rock then? What is rock in the 80s? What do you think of rock in the 80s or pop music? What's your general image of it?
It's something that basically is indefinable in many ways. Like, it's exploded in so many million different directions. It's exploded and imploded.
Yes, and it's used in commercials.
It's just got a use value that's like sort of what's the word? Like just non-stop.
No, you can't stop and say what's valuable.
Yeah,
and you think of. You know, you had in the 80s the back to vinyl movement. You had Neil Young refusing to do commercials. I think that's what he did. And shocked that they're hearing their favorite songs from the ear, golden era of the ear, the golden era of the ear in the 50s and 60s, showing up in crass TV commercials. That was shocking to the older musicians.
Right, right.
And that's another sign of the ear being weaker. Like, you're taking my most valuable private experiences and selling cars with it. You know, they had a problem with that.
Yeah, that caused a lot of a lot of pain.
Yeah, and identity crisis for the older, semi-literate baby boomers. Probably not a, by the 90s, if you've got a band, you're looking for who's going to buy your music for ads. I mean, you don't even care about the music you made in the old boomer sense. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay, so... This for, what's he say here? So rock balance. The ear is becoming weaker, so you need to juggle different kinds of music, and you're not going to say one music is better than another. So you're going to have, and this is for the general population. You're going to have the jazz guys advocating disorder or chaos or anti-environment to sweet saturated music, bounced off by the need for regular heartbeat acoustic space, and that's where rock comes in.
Right, okay.
So he says, it has changed, he says, it's radical in 1968 to think this, but it becomes an environmental actuality by the 70s, and bypasses whether Meltzer's for or against it. So it's even more radical, the degree of regularity, it has changed into even more vehicle in which change is so vital. Notice he italicized change. What he means by that is tactility. If you understand, it changes the instant translation of all these media environments into each other around the word that makes the market, and the word that makes the market is the White House and what it says in its press conferences, and that organizes the news, and that's what the phrase, the word is a bird, means.
Right.
What is it? The bird's the word? How does it begin?
Bird's the word, yeah. Bird's the word.
Yeah, and you could take any word as the word, whatever the White House says it is. McLuhan says the word makes the market. This song, The Bird is the Word, is expressing what's going on in the most profound levels of power in a mediated society in the global theater in the 60s. Doesn't matter what word it is. And it's...
Everybody's heard.
Yeah, that everybody's heard, and it's nature. It's real. It's a bird. So, okay, so what was I... So that environment is constant change. Everybody says, you know, the only thing we have constant today is change. Well, the tactile environment doesn't change. It's older media, which are the content of it, that changes faster and faster. And the viewer, once he gets a remote channel, he demands change. But it's actually frozen in the tactile space of the extended central nervous system, where everybody is equally accessible to what's happening and has access to everything. Not everything. They might not know about the Smiths or about the fact that Captain Beefheart went back into art, but they are watching the scanning global theater spectacle and in touch with basically because it's on their news every hour.
Right.
So change, in which change is so vital. It's not good, it's just vital. It's what happens when you have a tactile environment. Here is where rock and roll enters. All music is overstatement of a sort. That means extended ear. Any music after Cage and Company is overstated, overstatement. Correct. And rock and roll is overstated, overstatement, taken as subtly, as well as itself. If you understand what I'm saying about tactility, you can see the juggling here. It makes total sense. Any music, in other words, I'm assuming that the chaos musicians creating a new order, Cage and Coleman and Coltrane, they're overstating the role of music. They're making it noise.
Right.
But it only makes sense when ear is the past environment and you're trying to express the tactility or you're trying to respond to tactility, so it doesn't matter how you make your sound. Just make it hyper loud or irritating or overstated. Cage overstates silence and Coleman overstates noise. Or what is perceived as noise by the average literate ears in the 60s. And rock and roll is overstating, taken as subtlety, as well as itself. It is music, but it's also taken as a part of the word. It's what the teenage market is into, what the kids have to be programmed by. And it's overstatement is another way of saying it's beyond the dialectic between understatement and overstatement. And if it's beyond the dialectic, you're getting close to tactility. So rock and roll, as McLuhan said, is an environment, not music. It's a necessary medicine for people who are watching TV and have to learn literacy in their schools and factories and work in those industrial environments, but are massaged by the tactile TV environment and then the satellite environment, that global theater spectacle. The only way you're going to get a sense of balance is to have a hyper ear.
Right. Okay.
And that's what rock serves. I mean, you just think of someone from the 19th century walking into a club in 1978, you know, the disco club or the punk club. What would they think that, what was going on? They probably thought there was a gunfight going on or something.
Yeah, I think the world had fallen apart or something.
It's some explosive battle. The cannons were shooting each other, you know. But but we've been conditioned for 100 years to get used to louder and louder noises, to the point that loud noise became the entertainment release or the medicine.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's see. Where's another? Let's see what another paragraph would be. Let's look at this thing on page 112.
Okay.
The literate person looks for truth or meaning, hyper meaning. He says... At the bottom, 112, he says, truth may be unutterable in the sense of far beyond communication or in the sense of too blatantly immediate to be formulated into communicational rudiments. That's an exact description of the effect of tactility. Literate truth. Okay, so the truth of a tactile experience is approximated by rock. And it cannot be meaningful. And what it's trying to say could not be said because that would be just limited to what the mouth, the oral sense says. Tactile is all the senses. So, truth may be unutterable in the sense of far beyond communication. You could say communication is meaningful communication there, emphatic communication. But when it moves into beyond communication, it's emphatic. It's just a massage. Or in the sense of too blatantly immediate, there's a massage to be formulated into communicational rudiments. See, he's using the word communication as meaning, as matching. Get me?
Yeah.
So truth may be unutterable in the sense of far beyond communication, definitely far beyond oral or visual communication because it's tactile. And then he explains what I mean. Or in the sense of too blatantly immediate, nothing more immediate than the extended central nervous system, to be formulated into ear or eye communicational rudiments. The paradoxical use of this as the implicit mode of communication has been a definitive quality of music in general, and even more as pop paradoxicality of rock and roll. Makes total sense. You see, it was the music aspired to tactility unconsciously in the literate phase, classical music. So it's got a bit of that in there. But once you move into a tactile, fully extended tactile environment, the whole ear structure is obsolete. You can see it clearly, and for the ear to approximate tactility, it's going to do it in an overstatement-wise, and that's rock and roll.
Okay.
So the use of this paradoxical statement of his first sentence, truth may be, rock may be unutterable in the sense of far beyond communication or in the sense of too blatantly immediate to be formulated into communicational meaning. The paradoxical use of this dialectic as the implicit mode of communication has been the definitive quality of music. So music, massaging the ear in a hyper-literate culture of the last 300-400 years, the only way you got a release from that is having music. So it was not meant to communicate meaning. It just is, and you enjoy it as it is, as a massage. Well, when you have a literate environment that music is massaging to release, that's classical music. When you get to a tactile situation, what are you going to use to have release from that? It's not within the eye-ear dialectic. So you just take the ear, which is the closest to tactility, what McLuhan called the audile tactile, and hype it up so it sort of approximates the massage of the tactile environment, and it releases you. It tries to be counter-tactility. Therefore, it plays up the beat, plays up the regularity, which we had in the previous paragraph we were talking about, right? So it's pop paradoxicality. Someplace between the incapturably transitory, that's tactility, the incapturably, it's movement, but you can't capture it, and the imperceptibly infinite, that's another, you could say transitory is kinetic. So what is beyond kinetic, that's tactile, so you would say hyperkinetic, or the incapturably transitory, and then the visual is the infinite. McLuhan said looking off of the horizon, the infinite, is a visual statement of the visual sense, and the imperceptibly infinite. Again, he's mixing together paradoxical statements, contradictory adjectives, to point to something beyond that, which is tactile, which he says rock and roll gets close to.
Right.
So the someplace in the interval, the tactile is also the interval, someplace between. It's neither the encapsulatory transitory kinetic and neither the imperceptibly infinite is the stage upon which something is acted out between the ungraspably holy, always putting up another dialectic, and canceling at the same time between the ungraspably holy and the forgettably profane. Perfect description of the rock experience as an attempt to acousticize tactility. This is Cannonball and the Headhunters, Land of a Thousand Dances. Yeah, name any dance. This is the any rocking song.
Yeah.
But include the concept dance. This is the realm of the unknown tongue. The unknown tongue is not just what comes out of the mouth, it's also what the rest of the body does, including dancing.
Okay.
Now we come back to writing, what was that quote? The beginning, writing about architecture, dancing about architecture?
Right, yeah, writing about music is like dancing about architecture.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to go to... he's writing the same paragraph, each paragraph, set up a bunch of dialectics. Take one side blue and have the other side red, then mix in a little orange on the blue side, a little contradiction, and a little bit of yellow on the red side. So you've got two sides canceling themselves out, and they come together and are canceled, right?
Right, okay.
And that's like Finnegan's Wake. That's how Finnegan's Wake, he takes a basic force structure and plays ratios in it within it, and then cancels it. So you see how he's doing. He might have just said, "You want to know what rock criticism is? The best Beck rock critic is Finnegan's Wake. That's the best rock criticism."
Right.
Okay. So then, but you have to know how to read it. So he's actually doing a service here. He's translating Finnegan's Wake. If you know Finnegan's Wake, like I do. So page 119. He's now going to talk about the unknown, the quality of the unknown tongue, or the unknown aspect of the unknown tongue.
Right.
So at the bottom he says, that which is unknown, put it in quotes, about the unknown tongue is the manner in which it trespasses across the realm of separation between primary and secondary states. See? Two dialectics, primary and secondary. Trespasses, goes across, the realm of separation. Here's where the obscene, erotic face of rock and roll is united with a truly sexual structure. The greatest and most familiar analog to the unknown tongue, anyway. Anyway, I mean, remember, he cancels.
Yeah.
It puts a tone in there. Read that again. The greatest and most familiar analog to the unknown tongue in mere human experience is the mere orgasm. See, that's another part of your sensory apparatus. It's an intense peak experience, and you must include that within the realm of what tactility works with. So, an orgasm, as we all know, arises slowly as it builds up and suddenly strikes, leaving one back on Earth but perceptibly richer. The compression of neural experience in an orgasm is mirrored in rock's compression of eclectically selected elements into juxtapositions which yield unknown tongues. Perfect. And that means sex is dead. Since the discarnate state, electrified state, moves us past the chemical body, and for the chemical body, sex is a pretty important experience, but when you got a lot of the discarnate experience happening electrically with the extended central nervous system, the chemical body's enthusiasms or peak experiences become weaker and become a mere orgasm.
Right.
So the compression of neural experience. Now, the compression of neural experience is another way of defining tactility. You're that organism in the brain, or wherever it is, maybe it's in your astral body, who knows, your etheric body, that organizes consciousness, all the sensory data. It compresses it into a compressed, proper experience of, or holistic experience of, being. And if it's being done in the brain, it's the orchestrating of neural data, so that's tactility, the compression of neural experience. That's the compression of all the inputs in your sensory organs. In an orgasm, so it is mirrored in rock's compression of eclectically selected elements. That's what the brain says. Oh, look at all these different elements I'm sorting out. I'm sorting out the eye data, the ear data, the mouth data, the smell data, and the movement data. Eclectically selected elements into juxtapositions, and they can only be juxtapositions because tactility is not a container. It's just the relating into coherency, into juxtapositions which yield unknown tongues. Yes. Is mirrored in rock's compression which yield unknown tongues. In other words, the tactility is mirrored by rock, which itself is pretty tactile, though we think it's an ear and a kinetic experience. It's pretty tactile, therefore it's an unknown tongue. Then he says, in various musical contexts, the unknown tongue plays numerous roles by itself and in conjunction with an eclectic, selective attention in structuring musical experience and supply of focal points. Another complex statement saying it organizes but doesn't. It cancels, it erases. It implodes, it explodes. You see?
Right.
And so once you know he's playing a bunch of ratios in this sentence, then you can read it. In various musical contexts, in other words, in the ear, the unknown tongue, which is not the ear, plays numerous roles by itself because it is not just the ear. And in conjunction with an eclectic selective attention, that's what tactility is, an eclectic selective attention, in structuring the ear with a supply of things that look like earness while in the blur of constant change.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Yeah, this is awesome what I'm saying. In the context of repetition, novelty is a surprise. Now, that's another thing McLuhan said. When you get into an acoustic society before writing and in a tactile society after, explores sound in depth, and it's also, to the literate person, looks very repetitive. That's why there was so much alienation in the 60s and 70s. Everybody interpreted, literate people interpreted the tactile experience as boring, monotonous. But they didn't know how to see changes in sound in acoustic space, the subtle frequency changes, which a musician knows naturally. So it looks like it's repetition, a dull repetition, boring repetition. But actually, repetition is the way you explore tactility if you're using the ear. And you shade, you change the nuances. So given novelty and structural variety, given the endless tactile information overload of TV imagery in a tactile global theater environment, repetition is surprising. You know, it's like there's so much chaos going on.
Right, right.
That you focus on the heartbeat, which originally rock was, rock and roll. That's a reminder of stable chemical body reality. That appears surprising because it becomes an anti environment. It's we forgot about that.
It's a steadiness.
Yeah, and he used the word memory in there somewhere. Rock is memory, back in one of the quotes. That would, you can understand. It's remembering that there is regularity. And you don't want visual regularity. You want acoustic regularity, because that's closer to the tactile experience. So, you know, that's why the Nazis, why you had Nazi, you know, communism, fascism, robot behavior in the 30s. They were looking to repeat inside the tactile radio experience, or incipient tactile radio experience.
You're losing me on this.
Okay. The so-called hyper-mechanization of humanity in World War II.
Right.
That is the search for regularity, for repetition, in a literate industrial culture that's shocked by the beginning of the tactile experience, which every electric technology is an extension of tactility. So the telegraph was the early version of tactility. Then radio is even more tactile, but TV is more completely tactile because it has all the senses immediately visible. But
right.
the tactility of the electric effect is happening in the 19th century and in the 20th century, and therefore you look for regularity. That's the only way to get stabilized in an amorphous, tactile, unfocused blur experience.
Right, okay.
So I'm just saying you saw the military-industrial complex become enjoy repetition. It became surprising, and everybody joined in, and under the guise of going to war, the excuse of going to war, actually just trying to enjoy mass uniformity and regularity and repetition.
Right, okay.
But put it back in this smaller musical context, given novelty and structural variety, which is what happens in the tactile environment, repetition is surprising. It seems to be a novelty in itself. Within a framework of mixed novelty and repetition, surprise is of mixed variety, and expected surprise emerges. Expected surprise. See, constant flipping. Now, this is McLuhan's tetrad.
Right.
As well as frustration of such expectation. You got to have something surprising. It's also repeating within a tactile environment, so it's expected, and it has to be frustrating if you're a literate person.
Yeah.
And for tribal people, they get frustrated because their acoustic holy